Welcome to Hungry Authors, the show for aspiring authors who will stop at nothing to accomplish their writing and publishing dreams.
We're your hosts, Liz and Ariel, and we're honored that you're here. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the Hungry Authors Podcast. In today's episode, we have a really special guest, someone who has played a critical role in both mine and Liz's development as writers and freelancers. I'm talking about Jeff Goins, who's the author of several fantastic books, including The Art of Work, Real Artists Don't Starve, and even a book of poetry. Jeff and I met through his wife, Chantel, whom I've known for a few years before we all started working together because we were both editors. And it's really Chantel and Jeff who kind of took me under their wing when I started freelancing and gave me a lot of opportunities that I'm really grateful for. I've learned a lot from Jeff the past few years about how to write and think well, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Welcome to your long overdue interview on the Hungry Authors Podcast.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me, girls.
We're very excited. So we know you very well. We're all good friends. The three of us have known each other for a long time. You and Liz the longest, but you and me for a few years now. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell our listeners kind of where you are at? Probably a lot of them, you know, are familiar with some of your books, but tell people what you're doing now.
Yeah, maybe. I'm always surprised if people know something that I've written. A good friend of mine, John Acuff, used to say this, like he would sort of introduce himself on stage and he would say, you know, if you haven't heard about me, then you are like most people. And I always found that very affecting, you know, in a world of personal brands where like people presumptuously think that their reputations precede them. It's a big world. It's a huge internet. There's a lot of people doing a lot of things. I am one of those people. I'm an author. I've written 5 books. My name is Jeff. Last name Goins rhymes with coins. But for all of middle school, they thought my name was Groins. And so that was hard. And I've written 5 books, a couple of bestsellers. One of those was self-published. The rest were traditionally published. I accidentally got into ghostwriting a number of years ago. Liz helped me with that first book and turned that sort of side hustle into an agency. And myself and a handful of writers and editors work on maybe a dozen or so projects a year, primarily nonfiction works. And we say that we like to help authors take their big ideas and turn them into best-selling books.
Yeah, that's awesome. So let's say someone listening right now has not read one of your books. Which one should they go and buy right now and read first?
I think it depends, but I usually recommend The Art of Work. It was the most successful book. It's the most accessible book. It's a book about careers and work and meaning. So it's relevant to most people, I think. And so that's a pretty good place to start. If somebody like doesn't, I don't know, want the thing that everybody else gets, you know, they want something off the menu or whatever. My second recommendation is a book called The In-Between, which depending on how you count it was like the second or third book that I wrote. And it was a short little memoir about waiting. And I still think it has some of my better writing in it. And it's also my worst selling book. So you have sort of my best selling book, which is The Art of Work, and my worst selling book, which is The In Between.
Well, isn't that how it goes sometimes? It's like the work that you feel sure, you know, surest of and proudest of isn't necessarily what resonates with other people the most, but you know, that happens.
Yeah, I think so. And those, I mean, this is kind of incidental. I didn't intend for this to happen, but those two books sort of set up the discrepancy that we're going to talk about. And what got me into the whole idea of how do you write a book that isn't like guaranteed to sell, but where you're sort of stacking the deck in your favor. And that's where I stumbled on the idea of writing interesting books, not just good books.
Okay. So what do you mean by that? What is an interesting book?
An interesting book is any book that challenges its audience's assumptions. So when I wrote my first book, it's hard to like enumerate them chronologically, because what happened was I got a book deal, I wrote a book, turned it in to the publisher, and while they were editing it, I wrote another book that I self-published. And so I wrote and published a book and released it while my first book was being edited. So anyway, those two books kind of both came out at the same time in 2012. They both did relatively well, sold over 10,000 copies each within the first handful of months. So, that felt good. I felt like I was on a roll, and I was like, all right, now it's time for me to like write something artful. And so I wrote this third book, The In-Between. And I really wanted it to be like the best thing I'd ever written before. I commissioned an artist friend of mine to include little illustrations for every chapter. Like, I treated it like it was this really precious work of art. And it's some of my best writing. I hired an outside editor to edit the book before I ended up working with the editor at the publisher. And I'd never done that before. And I just like put everything I could in making this the best thing it possibly could be. And my thought was, well, if it's so good, I won't need to market it. And so I literally like didn't have a launch plan. The book's sales tanked. I didn't like that. So I eventually started like hustling a little bit and trying to get on podcasts and get friends to promote it. But when I tried to talk about it, I didn't know how to talk about it. And I realized that if you cannot talk about a book very easily, if you, the author, can't do it, then other people are not going to be able to do it. And if the book isn't sticky, it can't like travel easily, then it's the ideas is gonna not spread very easily. And if ideas can't spread easily, then the likelihood of people buying books that contain those ideas is low, because even today, word of mouth is still the number one driver of book sales, but it's, basically impossible to measure. There's not an easy way to measure it. And so when this book came out, I was like, this is the best thing that I've ever done. Obviously, it's just gonna like sell itself. People are gonna read it and think it's amazing and talk about it. When that didn't happen, I had to sort of reassess what I thought I knew. Then I just kind of looked around and started, paying attention to what other authors were doing. What's working, what's not working, what kind of books in my space, which was, self-help and personal development, which books were selling and why, and how could I begin to emulate that success? And the short of it was I saw that it wasn't the best books that were selling the best. It wasn't the best written books. Because when somebody buys a book, they don't know how well written it is. They've just heard about it. And so there was something about getting people to talk about a book, even if they hadn't read it, that was attractive to me. And I didn't know how to do that, but I remembered years before when Tim Ferriss had released the 4-Hour Work Week, and people were talking sort of in two schools of camp about it. One was, this is the best thing ever. I'm going to do this too and be financially independent tomorrow. And then there were the people like me who hadn't read the book who were like, that guy's full of crap. And I thought, that's interesting that he got so many people to talk about his book, even people who didn't like it, didn't like him, hadn't read the book. They were still promoting it. I remember like going out for like chicken wings with a friend, and he was talking about the 4-Hour Work Week, and I was like, like we were just talking about it. And so I understood after seeing sort of the flop of this book that I thought was going to do well. Okay, there's something else here, and I want to figure out how to crack that code. And I began to realize that it's not necessarily good ideas or concepts that make books sell, but it is interesting ones. And good is sort of like the quality level of the work, obviously. But interesting is something else. It's something that people can kind of talk about. They can agree and disagree with. And I'd been writing about that, talking about that, thinking about that, write something worth disagreeing with for a lot of years. And yet I wasn't really doing it with my books yet. And so this kind of started me on a different journey.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. So a framework that you use a decent amount that we've referenced before is everybody thinks X, but the truth is Y. And I have a question about that, because that definitely gets to your point about challenging assumptions, which is, in my opinion, and in the experience of a lot of the students who come through our cohorts and stuff, it's a little bit easier to do that with prescriptive books. But we have a lot of people that are memoirists or write creative nonfiction. So talk about this idea of an interesting idea or theme or like premise that challenges an assumption, but is for a narrative book. How do you think about that?
I think it still applies. People like to fight me on it. I've been teaching, writing, blogging, internet marketing for, I don't know, a dozen or so years now. And anytime I come up with some sort of framework or share some idea and it feels absolute, people want to challenge it. And I think that's fine. I like that quote from famous mathematician, all models are wrong, but some are useful. So when we talk about frameworks and you know systems, you guys have your own, I'm sure. Like what you're saying is, you know, this is a model. This usually works most of the time for most people when it's applied correctly. And you know, as any good parent should teach their children, rules are important, but like they're not the end all be all. Like no rule is absolutely essential, or very few. And one of the dangerous things that I'm teaching my kids right now is how to break the rules, and how to defy authorities, including myself. And I just like I'll just challenge them. Like my son had missed a couple of days of school for being sick or something, and he said, you know, Dad, when I came back from school, I didn't miss any assignments. Like everything went on just fine without me. And, you know, I was like, yeah, so what does that teach you? He was like, well, that I don't need to go to school as much as they think I do. And I was like, yeah, that's a good lesson to learn. And so, you know, a lot of rules are not meant to be broken, but they're meant to be understood. And in order to understand something, you have to test it. So all that to say, I would recommend that somebody work with this, play with it, especially if they've experienced maybe what I experienced, which was this isn't working. You know, I did write a memoir, and when I tried to talk about it, I couldn't get it to sell. I couldn't get people to talk about it. And so the first logical conclusion is, well, this just doesn't work for memoir. People don't buy this genre as much as they buy other genres, or there requires some, you know, there's another kind of marketing approach required here. I don't think that's true in that particular case. I think that was a case of sour grapes where I aimed at something I missed, and then I did the thing that most of us do, which is tell myself an easy explanation that gets me off the hook so that I don't have, like, I just go, oh, just, it's memoir. What are you going to do? You know, instead of kind of breaking it down and figuring out what did I do right, what did I do wrong, and how could I do this better? So I think everybody wants to have some sort of exception. They want to be the exception. That's not helpful in the world of books. Books are boring. They are not particularly innovative. You're always building on the knowledge that has come before, adding something new without being radically different. And whenever you think you are absolutely the exception to the rule, I would just be careful with that thinking. There's probably something that you haven't thought fully through. Many years ago, I was speaking at a blogging conference very, very early on in my career and trajectory as a writer, talking about personal branding, social media. And there was a woman in the audience and she said, I love writing, but I don't want to have to promote myself, you know, and I don't think I should have to do that. And I said, that's fine. You know, good on you. But don't expect anybody to read what you're writing. And she had this idea that like social media and building a platform, which I mean, guys, this was like 2012, 11, maybe. People were like, I don't need a platform, you know. It was sort of a conversation that was happening at the time. And I remember asking this woman in the audience. I was like, so let me get this straight. You know, you think social media is narcissistic. She goes, yeah, I don't, that's why I don't want to do it because it's selfish and narcissistic. And I was like, okay. And you just want to write your stuff, and you just want people to pay attention to it without you trying to earn their attention out of respect for them. And she goes, yeah. And I was like, and which one's narcissistic? Because I'm losing track here. Anyway, that's an aside. I don't think you're the exception. I think that books as a medium are always about saying something new. So that's sort of the bedrock. If you think about the history of publishing and publication, the word publication means to make public. And if you look at the great books of Western civilization, and as an author, you should look at the great books. You should know what has come before you. You should understand why in high school and colleges everywhere, even today, people are reading Augustine's Confessions. Why is this? Because it is the first memoir that was ever written, right? So that's interesting. Why should we understand, Marcus Aurelius's Meditations? Because it's kind of like one of the very first self-help books ever written, and it wasn't intended for anybody to read. What should we know about Beowulf, right? Why should we care about Shakespeare? It's not just that these are, people saying something a long time ago that you may like what they said or didn't like what they said, but all of them were doing something new. You should read Don Quixote if you want to be a novelist, because he invented the novel, right? It was the first novel ever. So what I'm saying here is, by entering the pantheon of books that have come before you, you are accepting a mantle, whether you realize it or not. You're stepping into the world of publishing, where people are making things public. They're saying something new. So the very act of writing a book, I think, means that you're saying something new. Otherwise, you wouldn't write the book, right? Like, you guys wrote a book together, and you a lot of the stuff that you say in your book, I imagine other people have said elsewhere. But
Definitely.
I also know
No,
this is
that's totally untrue. Josh, we're gonna cut that, please.
right. Yeah, you sound like an author.
There we go.
But if it were all, if everybody had said all that stuff already, and you weren't adding your own experience, your own perspective, even the way you arrange that stuff, there'd be no point in publishing the book. But of course, you're not doing that. So whether you write memoir, novels, prescriptive nonfiction, narrative nonfiction, there has to be something interesting to it. And another way to think about that is something new, a twist, right? So when in doubt, if you don't feel like you've got some everybody thinks X, but what's actually true is Y, then consider the concept of same but different. How is this similar to books like it, but different in some way? But again, I would argue, even if you're telling a story, say a memoir, a necessary essential element to storytelling is the element of surprise, meaning I didn't know that was true. All great stories essentially start out with the same idea, which is that things are not what they seem. And I would argue that every great novel, every great memoir is about something, and that something is not the main character. It is about some deep fundamental truth about humanity. My friend Marion Roach Smith, who I know you both know and are familiar with, she says all great memoir is about something, and that something is not me. And so I think that something is the subject. And I think, generally speaking, subjects that challenge what we think is true tend to resonate more with a larger audience. That's all I'm saying. You could write a memoir and not do that, but it's going to grab more people's attention if it's contributing something new to the genre and doing so in a way where they're making some sort of argument that surprises people.
Yeah. Okay, so I've been thinking about this a lot because do you know Harrison Scott Key?
Who's Harrison?
He wrote How to Stay Married. This was his most recent book, How to Stay Married.
Uh-uh.
Okay, well, he came in and spoke in Chattanooga just a couple nights ago, so I went and saw him. And I mean, what makes this book so interesting is that it's a memoir of him, you know, his discovery of his wife's long-term affair with a neighbor. It's a horrible, you know, situation, but this book is hilarious. I mean, it is laugh out loud funny. I mean, and it's heartbreaking, obviously. They end up staying together, which is not a spoiler. He says that from the beginning.
Sure.
But, you know, and I'm there is a lot to that book that is incredibly surprising for people. But I was trying to think of, like, if I were to put the subject of, or the, you know, the big idea of that book into this framework, I'm struggling with that a little bit. But I do think that you could say everybody thinks a memoir about your spouse's affair is going to be sad and, you know, dirge-like, and it's going to be depressing, and it's going to be, you know, awful. But the truth is that that kind of memoir could actually be hilarious and surprising and, you know, fascinating in that way too.
Yeah. Or it could be like, everybody thinks, you know, an affair is a necessary end to a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
When in truth, it could be the beginning of a whole new kind of relationship with your spouse.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't read it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's you know, good. if you go into prescriptive, like, that's Esther Perel's argument. One of her books is, everybody thinks that an affair means somebody wants to end their marriage, when in reality, it's a call for help to the spouse that they're cheating on. It's like saying, I'm lonely. I need something that I'm not getting, and I want it from you.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, maybe that's part of it. But what part do you think voice plays in adding something new and interesting to a genre?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of it. I think every author thinks they have a unique voice, and they're wrong. That what we call voice is something like intuition. I think there is a mysterious element to intuition. You know, I've bumped into it a handful of times in my life. Most of my female friends seem more well acquainted with it than my male friends. Just kind of like, you just know something, and you know it, and it just is what it is. And I've also seen that not prove accurate all the time. But with experience, over time, you can sort of hone your intuition, and you can figure out, when is this fear versus like a gut feeling versus nervousness versus wisdom of experience? Like it's hard to know what's what, right? I think your voice is like that, in the sense that there's something sort of deep and primal that like is you. And then there's all of the work that you have to do around that to really cultivate that your style. And so there may be something innate there, but the way that you develop that innate gift is by copying a lot of other, reading a lot and writing a lot. And when you read a lot, you're going to sound like the people that you're reading. And that's good. So just read widely, you know, so that by trying on a lot of other people's voices, you get a sense of what resonates with you. And I think of voice or style as like you're borrowing from all of these different sources. I always think of that video on YouTube, which is, you know, decades old now, called Everything is a Remix. And he talks about how all art, all creative expression is really just kind of borrowing from a bunch of different voices, you know, kind of like Austin Kleon Steel, like an artist concept. And you bring them all together into this composite that you know is not original. You know, you borrowed this from there and that from there, and this person influenced you and this thing happened over there. But you kind of bring all this stuff together, and then you like go, this is my thing, and I'm going to own it. And everybody goes, oh, you know, how original she is. So is voice enough to be interesting in and of itself? Maybe, but probably not. You know, if you want to take memoir, for example, I think that's kind of an interesting one. It's like who a person is, where they come from, and how they communicate. All of that creates a pretty interesting and unique perspective. When I think of memoir, I think of, you know, whenever I'm working with a client on a memoir project, you guys can probably relate to this. It's like, what is this book going to be like? Oh, this book is going to be like the next Eat, Pray, Love or Wild or, you know, whatever. I want to be just like Glennon Doyle, right? I've never heard
always.
That before. I was like, cool. Well, step one, spend 40 years of your life practicing this skill. But I think I don't think it's enough, because if you think of like think of somebody like Glennon Doyle, first of all, the whole empowered woman writing a memoir trope didn't always exist, you know? And that was really popularized by a handful of books that have been published in the past 20 years, including Liz Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love. And I always think that a book like that is actually saying, you know, women can have midlife crises too. Like if the cliche since the 1950s or before is like overworked man of the house buys a Ferrari and has an affair, you know, and the wife just has to sort of deal with it. You know, there's a whole string of books, including Cheryl Strayed's Wild, Eat, Pray, Love, and Glennon Doyle's book Untamed. You know, they're all kind of saying the same thing, but in their own unique ways, saying, you know, women can do this too. You know, we can blow our lives up and travel the world. We can go, you know, hiking out in the woods. Like, so I think in those cases, it wasn't just voice enough. It was, you know, this person who's typically not in this kind of role is stepping into this role and telling this story. What made Glennon Doyle really attractive is she was coming from the Christian world, and she was doing this thing in kind of this you know Christian space, which you know is a big no-no. Cheryl's book blew up because she's kind of doing a walk in the woods, but she's doing it as a woman, and these are not, you know, insignificant shifts. So I think voice is part of it, but identity has to be a big part of that too, meaning I'm going to be the first kind of person to write a book like this in this way.
Yeah. Well, and like one of my clients and past guests on this podcast, she was on a few weeks ago, maybe a month or two ago now. And now mutual friend Lucinda Halpern, she's a literary agent. We wrote her book Get Signed, and listeners of this podcast, I know you've heard this before, but she says there's three things that you need to get a book deal and ultimately have a successful book. You need a good idea or a big idea, a platform, and good writing or voicey. But then the twist is, but really you have to mostly just have two. Three is great, two is necessary. If you don't have a big platform, you have to be a really great writer, or you have to have a really great idea. But what people miss, to your Glennon Doyle point, like she is voicey and a fantastic writer, of course, but people also forget that when Carry On Warrior was published, she had already gone mega viral. So like
Totally.
it was a good idea, and she's an amazing writer, but she also did already have a huge platform, you know? And so
Yeah,
that
100%.
So it's like it wasn't just it, you know, obviously it had a legs because it was on the list for forever, and so it was also a good idea that resonated with a lot of people. But in terms of, you know, getting published and it, the initial like momentum, she already had like hundreds of thousands of followers, you know?
She
So
did. She was one of the OG mom bloggers,
yeah, exactly.
and was huge. I remember back in those days. I remember DMing Glennon when she was running momastery.com, you know, and we were shooting messages back and forth. Because if you were a blogger, like it was a really small world. Not everybody didn't know each other, but everybody was like watching each other, learning from each other, copying each other, trying to like. What's working? What are they doing? And she'd blown up. I mean, she was she has this ability to artfully cross boundaries. And she I think is at least very self-aware or knows how to leverage this personality. She's got a brand, which is like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm just my life is just a mess, and you know, it's okay. And I don't think that's insincere, but like it's very effective. And I believe that she knows what she's doing. And this is a trope of memoir. Anne Lamott talks about this in Bird by Bird. She says one of the things that you have to do as a memoir is so you have to convince the reader that their life is better than your life. Like that's important. Like they've got it better than you. And so when they read how terrible you are, how honest you are, how bad things have been, you know, they go, well, either she's been through this, and so I can get through what I'm going through. Or you go, well, at least my life isn't like that. And so I think voice is important, but it's it's you got to have the whole package. And platform is important, but I don't think people understand that there's just one critical skill here, and the critical skill is the ability to challenge assumptions. The reason Glennon Doyle has gone viral more than once, and when she got on Instagram, kind of started blowing that up, is she understands something that every artist has to figure out, which is how do I break rules? How do I cross boundaries? A good place to look in modern society right now is comedians. This is the job of a comic, is to always find whatever the line is and cross it in a socially acceptable way. If they jump way over the line, it's like, whoa, that was, can't say that like that. But if you ever watch a comedy special, they're like working you up. They're trying to get you to laugh at something that in normal, conversation, you wouldn't laugh at. And there's a catharsis that happens there that goes back beyond the days of, medieval jesters and whatnot. But understanding the artist, the creator, as like a trickster, as somebody who is challenging assumptions, they're crossing lines on purpose. This isn't just how you get people to laugh. This is how you get people to pay attention. This is how you get them to talk about you. This is how you become president of the United States. This is how you run a major brand campaign. And it's how you launch a best-selling book, by artfully crossing the right boundaries at the right time. And so you can do that through genre, like mm-hmm. Malcolm Gladwell did with The Tipping Point many years ago now, basically writing a business book as if it were a thriller novel. You can do it with the actual subject. Everybody thinks this, but what's actually true, or you can do it with the form of the book as well, or all of the above. But again, I would maintain you have to do something new. And you've got to do that because human beings want to feel smart. And one of the ways that they feel smart is by engaging with novelty, learning something new, reading about an experience that they're not familiar with. And I would challenge, any listeners who maybe write memoir, go read five of your favorite memoirs, or go find, a number of books in your space, and see if you can find the convention that they're challenging, the line that they're crossing, the thing that they're doing to try to surprise or engage the readers in a way that is hopefully going to stick with them.
So something else that I've heard you say often is to authors, tell the truth. So how do you kind of balance the need to push, push boundaries and kind of step over the line a little bit, but also not just be doing it in a way that's outrightly contrarian or saying something that's just like blatantly untrue? Because obviously telling the truth is a big part of this too, but how do you land on that? Or how do you like find what the truth may be if you're not quite sure? If you feel like, well, to be totally honest, I am kind of saying something that other people have said before, or that's not a big aha moment for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, Liz and I used to struggle with this when we were getting into ghostwriting together, is like, everybody thought their big idea was huge, and it usually wasn't. It was kind of boring. So I would say most authors default to playing it safe. Now, it depends. Like, if this person's like a professional marketer, they might be more prone to hyperbole than the average person. But most authors I've encountered aren't that person. They're not a genius at attracting attention. They're somebody who knows something about a particular skill set or knowledge base, or they're somebody who has had a particular experience that is noteworthy or notable, and they want to share it with other people. And so they go, well, this is just what happened. And that's never true. There's never just one set of circumstances that happened, right? There are lots of different ways to look at lots of different events in your life. There are lots of different ways to consider what you know and how you can communicate it in the most interesting way possible. As Emily Dickinson said many years ago, you know, tell the truth, but tell it slant. You know, you could say that poetry is the art of telling the truth, but telling it in a very sideways fashion that is unique and beautiful and hopefully memorable. So the advice would be like, you know, step one, know the space that you're in. Know what your genre is. This is not something that we think about as much as maybe our predecessors, previous generations of authors had to think about. Like, what category your book was in determined what shelf it was on, and therefore who may or may not find it. That's not really a thing anymore. You know, Amazon has hundreds of categories. People don't have to go to a bookshelf to find your book. You know, where it may get lost in a sea of books. But that was a big, big deal for a long time. And I think it's an important question to ask yourself. When I started early on in this process, I met Marion Roach Smith, whom I mentioned earlier. She kind of became an informal mentor to me. And at one point, you know, she asked me, what kind of writer are you? What kind of writer do you want to be? And I said, a successful one. And that wasn't the answer she was looking for. She was like, so like self-help, how-to, memoir, business, advice, like there are categories of writing. And if you don't understand the one that you're in, you're not going to know what the rules and conventions are. Therefore, you're not going to know what you should or should not be doing to get people excited and interested in whatever you're saying. So one, actually know what space you're in. Two, get acquainted with what you can and cannot do in that space, right? So if you're a professional marketer, you know, how you title your book conventionally is going to be very different from if you write poetry or memoir, right? So knowing kind of what the rules are, what the conventions are, is really important. And then the third step would be to pick the most interesting thing that you can do to challenge the status quo. Meaning, if I'm a plumber and I write about plumbing, and most plumbing books say X, and I decide that's wrong, you know, that's stupid and they shouldn't do that, you know, and I decide, you know, we don't even need plumbers anymore because everybody can be their own plumber and it's not that difficult. And I decide that my position is everybody can be a plumber. When you figure out that third piece of it, I actually encourage you to start with something that sounds interesting and exciting to you that might not be true. So the short way to say that is lie first, choose an interesting lie, and then find ways to make it true. And so, you know, and it's like, there is not a line between true and false. There is a spectrum from things that probably are to probably are not for most things. You know, even the statement, the sky is blue. It's like, well, what shade of blue and on what day? It's not blue right now. It's gray. It's about to rain outside. And sometimes it's red when the sun sets. So, you know, all of reality is based on this spectrum of probability. I don't know how to talk about these things without getting metaphysical. So you'll have to bear with me. But
fine.
you guys know. But usually, when you're thinking about something that could be true, it's like, well, everybody can be a plumber. Maybe not everybody, but like maybe more than just the people that are plumbers. Okay, sure. And like you can find ways to begin to move it back into the land of like truthiness. And really, what you want is you want the thing that is right on the line, as close to the line as possible, between being absolutely unbelievable and totally normal, right? And so another way to think about this is interesting is always where the ordinary meets the absurd. And it's way easier to start a little absurd and then kind of back off a few notches than it is to start very conservatively with what we might consider a good but boring idea and like try to pizzazz it up. This is the thing I learned as a marketer working for a nonprofit many years ago, which is how Liz and I first got to know each other, is lots of people wanted to create crappy products and like use cool pictures and cool copy to make it sound exciting. And people do that with books too. They like tell their life story and they're like, how do I market it? Every word you put on the page is a form of how this thing is going to be talked about. And so that's why I advocate for sort of thinking about the marketing at the outset. What do you want people to say about this? What is the most interesting thing that you could say about this subject? And then how can you find ways to make it true? And oh, by the way, if you, you know, write memoir, for example, those books are never true. You know, they've changed the dialogue. They've changed some of the characters. They've moved around the events sometimes. Why? Because it makes for a more interesting story.
Yeah. And what you talked about with kind of starting with like the most extreme, the most, you know, potentially untrue version of your argument. I think we did kind of have done that with Hungry Authors. We started with, you know, our original idea was something like anybody can get a book deal if they have these things. And we've kind of, you know, we've walked that back a little bit because obviously not everybody is going to get a book deal. But we do believe that more people can get book deals than do if they had the right plan and the right, you know, right setup. So,
and when we wrote the proposal and try and sell it and pitch it, we do say anybody. Like we do come out with the bold statement. You know what I mean?
You have to be bold.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then on podcasts like this, we're like, well, not anybody. But like, you know, we, when we try and sell it and we talk about it publicly, yeah, we say anybody.
But
I, yeah, go ahead.
Jeff, I was going to say, you are so good at doing that, not just kind of on the idea level, but also really in the sentence level. When you and I work with authors, we kind of have this like this dynamic where I come in and I'm like, okay, let's add the structure and make sure it like it all works and stuff. And then you come in and you make it all sound amazing and good, and you put all of the like the awesomeness in it. So how do you do that? I mean, you know, you are probably the best person I know who can do that, who can make sentences sound so good. How have you learned and honed that skill?
Well, I actually think of it as a liability. I'm so obsessed with the sentence level quality of writing that it slows me down. The first time I worked on a ghostwriting book, Liz was my assistant, and I was interviewing my friend Grant. And we were working on this book together, and I had all these interviews that I transcribed, and I was so overwhelmed by all the copy, you know, just all the words. I didn't even know what to do. Like, what am I supposed to do? Just start editing a transcript? You know, I had been the one conducting the interview, and I was still like, I don't know what to do with any of this. So I, in an act of desperation, I was like, Liz works with me. She wants to write books. I was like, hey, do you want to help me with this? And when in reality, I was just so overwhelmed, I didn't know what to do. And I still feel that way with books. It's really, really hard for me to translate from like super raw ideas into like first manuscript. And so I need help with that. Where does it come from? It probably comes from writing poetry as a teenager and then writing songs and probably having ADD, you know, and like I can't ignore bad writing or ineloquent writing. And so, it comes from having this weird hyperfixation on certain details and not being able to ignore them. And then, you know, being pretty practiced at just rewriting stuff over and over and over again. I think the best education for a writer is the kind of education I've gotten. It's the kind of tried to give other writers when they want it. Is to work with another writer who's more experienced than you on a piece of writing and say you write this piece and then give it to them and watch them rewrite it and give it back to you. And I think Liz asked me this early on in our working together, like, can you show me what you did so I can understand how you did that? And like, it's hard to teach a thing that is intuitive, that is like an intuitive craft that you kind of learned on your own privately. You don't know what you said.
No. And I was like, oh, well, okay, cool. Thanks.
I think you wanted me to explain
no,
it to you.
No, you didn't. You didn't. Of course you didn't say that. I'm joking.
I mean, I like it's you just
said,
have to
look at the Word doc, you dummy. It's right there.
All right. Interview's over. I'm out of here. But it's like it's a hard thing to explain. It's like, how do you swing a bat or a golf club or kick a soccer ball? It's like, you've got to find it. Steve Pressfield actually has a lesser known little nonfiction book called The Authentic Swing, which is about finding your artistic voice, finding your creative voice. But he draws the analogy between your voice and a golfer's swing, which is that there's no like just one right way to swing a golf club. There are fundamentals that you have to learn, but then you have to like find your swing because nobody has your body, your length of arms. Like, it's a unique thing, and you have to find that as a writer as well. So I would say it comes from like poetry, songwriting, and then years and years of copywriting, which is all about like live or die at a sentence level. And so I don't think of there's no such thing as fluff. Like, it's either in there or it's like because it belongs there, or you need to cut it. And yeah, like it's ideal when you can collaborate with somebody, or and it doesn't have to be another writer, it could be an editor. I mean, usually the writer editor dynamic is the writer is kind of the crazy genius, artist type, and the editor is the person who's holding the form. I love that scene in that movie about Max Perkins with Colin Firth and Tom Wolfe, called Genius, where Wolfe brings in this like 2,000-page book, and Max cuts it down to like 1,000 pages, and he's like pissed at him. He's like, "How dare you do this to my, da, da, da." But that's the process of like making something beautiful, but also making it work, and it's a dance.
Well, this is a little bit more sh like structural or high level than sentence level writing, but I remember years ago, when I first kind of started taking on my own clients, I felt like I really knew what to do with prescriptive people. I more or less had a template. It's a little bit more formulaic. And I got my first memoirist. And I paid for time with a really successful ghostwriter. And I was just like, okay, I don't know what to do with a memoir. Like, I don't know how to like find it, or what this is supposed to be. And so I paid for time with this really amazing ghostwriter who does memoir. And she gave me lots of great advice, but I just kept asking over and over again, like, so what do you like, how do I, what do I ask? Like, it's not nearly as plug and play, not to reduce prescriptive books to that. But if you're teaching something, there's a little bit of like, you need an example, you need the how to, you need the, And she was just, and eventually I think she just got sick of me kind of asking the same question in different ways. And she was like, you just find it along the way. And I was like, you're telling me this? You've done this over and over again for really well-known people. And you're just telling me I'm going to find it? Like, then that was it. Like, that's what my $350 like got me. And it really was like, it's true. I mean, it turned out to be true. Like, I've done a couple memoirs since, and it's like, it is at the beginning, you just find it along the way, especially for narrative books. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, to your point of just like, whatever, figuring it out, practicing, like there's no right way. Like there is no one way. You get in there and you eventually figure it out along the way.
One of my favorite quotes about writing is by Somerset Maugham, I think is that who it is? And he says, there are three rules to writing. Unfortunately, nobody knows what they are. And it is like that. It's like, that there's a right way to do this, but like nobody's telling you what that is. And it's not because they're like withholding something, it's because they can't. It is like ineffable. You can't actually say it in words. And if you could say, do this, then do this, it would be this kind of like very inelegant, herky jerky thing. I worked with somebody who basically believed that in order to be a great writer, you basically had to write a million words, like you just had to get through 1 million words before you could like really, do it well. And that was probably something close to the 10,000 hour rule. But I like it's not just hours. It's like you have to work with words. You have to see how they fit together. And there's no shortcut to that, which is why being a ghostwriter is great practice, because you're going to work on lots of books, much more so than if you're just kind of doing it on your own. And you can do what many of the great writers throughout history have done, which is copy the works of other great writers, literally writing them, you know, word for word, to feel like what it feels like to write words like that. And I think that's a very powerful exercise.
Yeah, I completely agree. All right, Jeff, any final thoughts? I'd love to know just like what's the best piece of writing advice you've gotten, and maybe we can end on that.
Sure. Yeah, that's an easy one. The best piece of writing advice I got was in the form of a criticism. It was from my friend Marion, whom I mentioned a few times, so she'll be the star of the show. I had written a book, and I'd had it edited, and everybody told me it was great, and something still felt off to me. And so I let Marion read it, and I said, "What's wrong?" I said, "You know, like, the publisher says it's great, the editor says it's great. Like, what do you think?" She said, "Someone lied to you." and she basically said, "You can do better. You can try harder." And I think the best advice there was that it was like, it can always be better. Like that's good to remember. And there's a certain point at which you have to ship, but it can always be better. The second piece of writing advice from an editor was, I was working on a book, nonfiction book, and I was spending all this time talking about it, thinking about it, reading about it, but I wasn't writing. And I said to him, I said, I'm not doing any writing. I'm just thinking about writing. And he said, thinking about writing is writing. And I think that's true. I think that's really, really true. A book can only be as deep or as interesting as the thinking behind it. And so going, you know, when I'm writing a book, half the time I'm going for walks, thinking, and then I'll figure it out and I'll come back and write it down.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, you're not on social media. So Where is the best place for people to find you and connect with you? You are hosting an incredible retreat that I'm very jealous about in Oxford this summer, where I know I'm can't tell you how tempted I am, but where should people connect with you and learn more about stuff like that?
I'm on Substack. You can find me at jeffgoins.substack.com. That's kind of my digital home right now. Still figuring out what to do with the rest of it, but I'm there. And like I said, we run an agency for authors. If anybody's working on a book or a writer who's interested in getting into ghostwriting, you can learn more about us at freshcomplaint.com.
Cool. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you're a hungry author and you want to learn more about our community and courses, head over to hungryauthors.com. Remember, you have a story and a message worth sharing, and if you've got the hunger, you can make it happen.